right? But what is that we can find unsatisfactory about this definition? Why we cannot be completely happy with this? What do you think? Or are you completely happy with it? Let's just try. So there are at least two things that make me unhappy about this definition. So the first one is that this definition doesn't tell you what is a face. So yeah, we have the face one, the face two, the face three. We don't even know if they are different faces. Yeah, there is a quantum phase transition in between, but they could be the same phase. Or if they are different, in what are they different? So what really is a quantum phase other than the domain of analyticity? So we understand that something qualitatively may change because there is some critical phenomenon in between. Namely, the ground state energy density is non-analytic. But what is really changing? Why they are in what they are different? So the first problem of this definition is that so far it's a bit empty. Doesn't contain much.
What you're saying is there's no analog of what we understand in classical continuous phase transitions, like the symmetry that distinguishes.
Yes, exactly. So we will see that, in fact, in the first example that we give, again, symmetry will be, so today we see that symmetry and symmetry breaking are the archetypical patterns in which we understand quantum phases. And one of the goals of this course is also to understand that the story doesn't end there. So quantum phases are richer than classical phases, so symmetry doesn't exhaust all the possibilities. So for one thing, we need to introduce some other concept. So today we talk about symmetry. But there is a second difficulty here, is that this definition is a bit ambiguous. In what? Because you see, given the Hamiltonian, I have faces. Okay? But so the phase diagram is a property of this Hamiltonian. So now imagine that I add, so that I have two, this Hamiltonian, okay? And then I add a second Hamiltonian, H prime. So my total Hamiltonian, that depends on one parameter, lambda 3. Or can depend on all of three of them. But there is a new one. Okay? So I am adding one coordinate here. So this means that now in the phase diagram of this new Hamiltonian, that I don't know what it is right now, but there could be a path between a point in P1 and a point in P2 in which I do not encounter any boundary because I have this new dimension. I can go around this line, right? So now suddenly we see that this quantum state and this quantum state are in the same phase. So before we said, oh, they are in two different phases. Because there is a phase transition in between. Now we say, oh, but they're in the same, they are the same quantum state. So whether they are connectable or not depends on the Hamiltonian. And it's not a property of the quantum state. And this is... So this is a bit ambiguous, right? We would like to understand clearly what it means for one quantum wave function to represent a quantum phase. So we need to specify a little bit more our definition in order to understand these things. Okay. So in order to do all this, we need some preliminaries, because one basic assumption that found a justification what we said yesterday is that our quantum many-body systems are described by so-called local Hamiltonians. So by local Hamiltonians, I mean Hamiltonians in which the interactions have some locality. So why this is necessary? So yesterday, we actually touched this point. If interactions are long-ranged, so if they are stronger than exponential, you may not have the thermodynamic limit. Okay? So we need interactions that decay very fast. And in this course, we will take for sake of simplicity, we'll take a more extreme point of view in which interactions are entirely local. So they do not have, they have a finite range. This is what it means, completely finite range. So we, in order to describe finite range interactions, we need the notion of a graph. Okay? Because a graph tells us when two points are nearest neighbors, local interactions will be an interaction, in some sense, between nearest neighbors. Okay? So let's say, introduce what is a graph. So a graph is a pair. And this is, lambda is a set. Okay? And E, which is called the set of, let me put it by quotation marks, edges. E is a subset of the power set of lambda. So what is the power set of lambda? It's the set that contains all the points in lambda, all the pairs of points in lambda, all the triples of points in lambda, and so on and so forth. So E is the sum specification of, is some subset, specified subset inside P lambda. So let's make an example. So let's say that lambda is this set of points. And now I take as a subset in the power set the following pairs. Okay. So E for me is the set of all these pairs. And people sometimes draw them like links and say, oh, this is our graph. So what do I have? Something like this. Okay. So this is the typical graph that people are used to, that is made of just links between pairs. But actually, our definition is a bit more general. We can also have triples. So for instance, we could have something like this. So in our set of edges, most of the edges contain 2 points, but there is some edge that contains 3 points. So the specification, what is the subset, tells you what is the graph. It specifies the edges, okay? So once we specify this definition, then we have a few more definitions. One is the notion of degree of a node or vertex. So the set of these points is called set of vertices or nodes or something else. So the degree is just the number of points in the graph such that both x and y belong to an edge. So to be sure, if I have the following edges from this point x, so actually, no, let me, this one is only good for, is the number of edges, let me write it like this, such that belongs to that edge. Okay, that's better. So in this case, the degree of x is 3. We have 3 edges that come out of x. Another definition is that of a path between x and y. A path between x and y is an intersection of edges of a certain number, large capital L of edges, such that in some ordered set, such that their intersection of 2 consecutive edges is not null, and such that both x and y belong to the path. Okay? And the number L is called the length of this path. So it's the number of edges that connect, of intersecting edges that connect 2 points. The distance between x and y, so let me call it distance between x and y, or d between x and y, is instead the minimum over all the paths of the length of these paths that connect x and y. Okay, so this is the so-called graph distance. Yep.
In the definition up there, you're not restricting yourself to having x and y be at either end of the path. Is that correct?
Yeah, I'm not. But you see that when I talk about the distance between x and y, your path must be like that. Of course, there are still many paths that are like that. And finally, we call the so if I have a subset x of points in our graph, well, the volume of x, well, this is just the number of points that are in x, and the diameter of x is just the minimum distance between, it's the maximum distance between any pair among all the possible pairs of points in X. So that is the diameter of X. Okay. So this is all the graph theory we need. And now, with these definitions, we can introduce what is the notion of a local quantum system. And another way of calling this local quantum system is generalized spin system. So between these two definitions, there is only one small difference that I will highlight in a second. Okay, so first of all, we need to define what is a local operator. And to do this, so we first define what is the Hilbert space associated to our graph. Okay? So associated to our graph, we have a Hilbert space lambda, H lambda, that is supposed to be the tensor product of many Hilbert spaces. So what we do is that to every point in lambda, we associate a Hilbert space that we call local Hilbert space. So we have our graph, and at each point there is a Hilbert space. Okay? So in the case we speak of a generalized spin system, we will speak of a generalized spin system in the case in which the dimension of these local Hilbert spaces is finite. Okay? In this case, we will call it a generalized spin system. Otherwise, it's just a local quantum system. Okay, so we have the local Hilbert space, and the Hilbert space of the whole system is just the tensor product of all these guys. Okay, so this is the total Hilbert space. Then, of course, we can associate other Hilbert spaces to any bunch of points in my graph. So I can take some subset of lambda, and to this I can associate H to this subset just being the tensor product of all the local Hilbert spaces associated to each point in X. Okay? Now, if I have some operator in my total Hilbert space, do you know what is the support of an operator? Okay. So imagine that this operator, if this operator can be written in this way. So first of all, I can split lambda in some x, so I have some subset x union the complement of x. So I can always do that. So if O can be written like some operator acting on this Hilbert, on the Hilbert space associated to Hx, tensor, the identity on the Hilbert space associated to the complement of X, then the support of O is hx. So in the following, very often I will, in the speaking, I will sometimes mix up the subset X, a set of points, and its associated Hilbert space. And the context would make it clear what I'm talking about. Okay? So I might say, oh, if we have an operator on X. Of course, what I mean is that we have an operator that is acting on the Hilbert space that is associated to the subset X. But okay, so this is an operator with support on X. We say that this operator is R local if the diameter of its support is smaller than R. So if the diameter of the support of O is smaller than R. Or if you want, if the diameter of X is smaller than R. It's the same thing. Okay. So for instance, in this example, we have, if we have operators that act on the edges of this graph, they would be too local. But we might have on the same graph operators that act on, for instance, these 5 points, even if even if there is no edge between these 5 points. Okay? So one thing is the underlying graph, and one other thing is the support of some operator. So in this case, this operator would be 5 local. Okay. So now we can define what is a R local Hamiltonian. This one?
Yeah, above. In the brackets. In the big brackets.
GSS?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. So the local Hilbert space can be any Hilbert space. It can be the Hilbert space of a harmonic oscillator, right? Mm-hmm. In this case, it would be infinite dimensional. Mm-hmm. Right? It's a L2. Or it can be a finite dimensional Hilbert space. So like a 2-level system or a 5-level system. So when the local Hilbert spaces are all finite dimensional, we will call our quantum system a generalized spin system. So this is just a name. So a R local Hamiltonian is just the sum of R local operators, Hermitian operators. Okay?
And also, maybe understand, you write in the right, in the bottom, that O is a part of H lambda, but it's not entirely true because H lambda is a space and O is an operator in this space, not an element.
What?
When you write O is a part of H lambda, it is left.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I understand that it's not entirely correct because O is an operator in the space, not an element in the space.
Oh, no, you're right. Sorry. No, so the. So. Sorry about that. So this is the set of linear operators on H. Sorry?
Do we require operators to be bounded?
Okay, so very good question. Usually, I mean, in the general definition, not. We only require them to be bounded from below, which is the usual thing. However, of course, in this case, they come completely bounded by for free because the Hilbert space is finite dimension. So if I have a set, basically I have a set of these subsets X, I associate to them some Hermitian operators phi X. So this is Hermitian. And the diameter of X is bounded by R. Then my Hamiltonian is just the sum of these guys. Okay? So this is a local quantum system. So the other thing that we require is that these operators commute when they have a non-intersecting support. Okay, so they're so-called bosonic operators. So phi of x intersected phi y. Sorry, these two operators commute when x intersected y is void. Okay. So we will require also this property. Okay, so example. And this is the paramount example that we'll study. And as simple as this example is, there are still almost every day papers that come out in which they show something new about this model. Okay? So it is the so-called quantumizing model. So actually, let me write it. Okay, let me write the quantumizing model. Then Thursday, you will learn how to diagonalize a generalization of this model that is called quantum XY. So it's the following. So I have my Hamiltonian. So I have some graph, OK? And my graph is such that all the edges are links. And we have this Hamiltonian. So in what way this is an example? In what way this has this form? So my subsets are allowed to take two forms. Either they are sites in my lattice. And when it's a site, then I associate the operator sigma x at the site I. What? Ij? Oh, sorry. Okay. Or they are links, so links are pairs of points, ij. And to the link ij, I associate this. So of course, these operators are the Pauli matrices. So you know they have a certain algebra, namely that sigma x, sigma z anti-commute when they are on the same site. And that they square to the identity. So sigma x squared equals sigma z squared is equal to the identity. Okay? So these are the Pauli matrices. Of course, the Hilbert space of this Hamiltonian is just the tensor product of spins 1 half. So this is the total one. So at every site, I have a spin 1 half. The Hilbert space of spin 1 half is C2. So it's just the Hilbert space with the two states with the complex coefficients. Right? So I could write this like the span of two vectors that I can call 0 and 1. And these linear combinations are allowed to take complex coefficients. Are you familiar with this? Is it okay? Yeah, just ask me if there is something that sounds foreign to you. Okay, so this is a two local Hamiltonian. It's the sum of one body terms and two body terms. Okay? So this can be defined in any graph, even if the graph is not regular, or if the graph is a lattice and it has a dimension, can be defined in every dimension. But in particular, we will focus, especially in the case where we have the very simplest graph, that is the chain. So it's a one-dimensional graph. We have a chain that are labeled by the index I. In this case, ij is ii plus 1. This is the nearest neighbors. Okay, so we sum over all these two body terms. Okay, so this is the quantumizing model. And now we want to understand especially the ground state of this model. So this model, by the way, depends on one parameter, that is G. J here doesn't play any role. So I could even not put it. I don't know why I put it. So by changing G, I actually change the relative weight of these two terms. So before looking at the ground state, we must notice something, is that this Hamiltonian has a global symmetry. So what is a symmetry, by the way? Somebody has to tell me this. What is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian? No, no, you have to speak loud. A group of transformations that leave the Hamiltonian invariant. Very good. It's not enough, though, because these transformations must be non-trivial. Sure. Non-trivial transformation. So imagine that I gave you some operator such that for every state in the Hilbert space, this is true. Then I have a Hamiltonian that commutes, so that is left invariant by this operator. So commuting and being invariant under the adjoint action of the operator is the same thing, right? So the Hamiltonian is still invariant, but we don't call this a symmetry, okay? So because this is a trivial transformation. So the reason why I bring this up, it's not to be picky about mathematical definitions, but because this is actually a very important case, which is the gauge structure. So the difference between symmetry and gauge structure is this, that in one case, in the gauge structure, transformations are trivial. And in symmetries, they are real transformations. So for this reason, one should not talk about gauge symmetry in the sense that whatever is a gauge in quantum mechanics is not a symmetry. It's not a transformation that leaves invariant the Hamiltonian, because it's not a transformation at all. It is something like this. So, and this is basically a relabeling. Okay. But so when you have a real transformation, this is a symmetry. And as I said, it's a global symmetry. So who of you can guess or knows already what is the global symmetry of this Hamiltonian? Flipping the what?
Like spinning the wire 180 degrees.
I'm not entirely sure if I understand, because also this, even if you don't have a chain, so even if you don't have a very clear geometric picture, even if you have a very irregular graph, it still has the same symmetry. So this is an algebraic property. Here, x and z do not mean directions in space. They just mean some algebra. They just mean that when they are on the same side, they anti-commute. This is all I mean. So yes, I mean something like that. So to be precise, this operator, this is a global operator that is the tensor product of the operator sigma x on the whole set of spins in my Hilbert space. So this is not a local operator. Okay. So you see that for this operator, this is true. Can you see that? So obviously this operator has to commute with all the sigma x's because the same polymatrix is always commute. But I just said sigma x and sigma z anti-commute. However, no matter which of these pairs I choose, I always get two anti-commutations, which become two anti-commutations. If you do two lines calculation, you see it's a commutation. So it commutes. And as you can see, it commutes for every g. So the whole model always commutes. So this sim what?
But here t is not a trivial transformation.
It's not a trivial transformation. So this is a symmetry. It's not a gauged structure. It's a real symmetry. And this symmetry is no, the trivial transformation is this one. So I brought it up because I said, look, you have to make sure the transformation is non-trivial. Otherwise, you are talking of something else, which is the gauge structure. And that was not just a me being finicky about math. It has a meaning. So this symmetry is called the Z2 symmetry. So why it's called the Z2? So somehow I'm saying that the symmetry group is Z2. So, but why it's Z2? Yeah. So if you apply it twice, you have the square of all this, it squares to the identity. So at this point, you have exhausted all the elements in the group. So your group, your symmetry group, must contain the identity, right? Because it's a group, and it has always the identity, nt, and that's it. And this is a representation. So I shouldn't write equal, but it is a representation of Z2, which is the simplest possible group. Okay? Okay, so far so good. We know that this Hamiltonian is Z2 symmetric for every value of G. So this means that if we move within the phase diagram of this Hamiltonian, we would always preserve the symmetry. So let me say it better. If we change the Hamiltonian by varying this parameter, we always have the Z2 symmetry. But what happens to the ground state? So let's see two limiting cases. So the limit first case, G very, very large. Today in the tutorial, you will also do the perturbation theory around these two limit points. Okay? So you will, and basically the lesson that you learn is that the properties that are at the limit points survive in some neighborhood of them, given by the radius of convergence of perturbation theory. And then we see what it is. So let's see the first limit. So in this limit, you have only this Hamiltonian. Very simple Hamiltonian. What is the ground state of this Hamiltonian? Oh, so by the way, let me specify some notations. And I call spin up the eigenvector of eigenvalue 1 of sigma z. And similarly, spin down the one with eigenvalue minus 1. Okay? Whereas the eigenvectors of sigma x, I will call them plus and minus. Okay? So it is in this basis that the poly operators have the familiar shape, like sigma x being this, for instance, and sigma z being this. In this basis. Okay? If you go to this basis, they swap. And you should remember that the relationship between these two bases is that plus and minus are the equal superposition with plus or minus of these two. Okay? Okay, so when the Hamiltonian is just sigma x, so what is the ground state? Huh? They're all plus. So for every spin, I have the plus on here. And so in this way, I minimize the energy, and all in this way. The ground state is unique. We call this, so notice that this is a product state. It's actually a completely product state. What you see, it's a product state in each of the degrees of freedom. If you compute the magnetization is the expectation value or the average, summing over all the spins, of sigma z, you find zero. And also correlation functions means the expectation value of these operators are zero. If you do perturbation theory, so when today you do perturbation theory, you will see that for G not infinity but large, you would have that this thing decays exponentially with some characteristic length psi that today you will compute. This property that there is no, let me put it by commas, spontaneous magnetization means that this is a name, means that this phase, and again, this is a phase, not just one point. In perturbation theory, you will see that this property survives, is a paramagnet. So why I'm talking about spontaneous magnetization and why I'm choosing sigma z, right? Because if I chose a sigma x, then I would have something that is different from zero. So, but why do I have to choose sigma z? So mathematically, the spontaneous magnetization is the acquisition of a non-vanishing expectation value of some operator that breaks the symmetry. Sigma x commutes with the symmetry. Physically, this means that there is nothing spontaneous in having the spins aligned in the direction x if our Hamiltonian is forcing them to go towards x. Okay? So this is not the direction in which we want to see if there is some spontaneous ordering. The spontaneous ordering, like in classical statistical mechanics, you obtain it by adding some small field and then sending it to zero. But if you send this to zero, you have no Hamiltonian at all. So if you send it to zero, in fact, you have the completely disordered state. Any state is the eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, of the null Hamiltonian. So it is a paramagnet. So that's why you have to look in the z direction. Okay. And now, second case, g going to zero. So this is the interesting. Yep.
Does that mean that you could also have computed the magnetization in the y direction and you would get also zero?
Yep. So in this case, okay, so what is the ground state? You have to tell me. All spins in the same direction, because in this case we only have this term, and we get a energy minus j every time a pair of spins are in the same direction. So the minimum is when all spins are in the same direction. So, but there are two ways of putting all spins in the same direction, right? So they could be all up or they could be all down. And so already, so every time, I mean, the first time I studied this stuff, and every time I hear it explaining, here I already get anxious because I'm already not happy with this. Because so far we are just talking about the ground state. So of course, all we are saying is not that, you know, this is quantum mechanics. We have linear combinations. So a quantum ground state is not like a classical ground state. You cannot really say that these are the two ground states. You're just saying that this is a basis in the ground space that is two-dimensional. And when people pick this immediately, because if you pick this basis, you have something interesting. So this basis is, okay, so this ground state, let me go back for a second, is also as asymmetric as the Hamiltonian. So T psi 0 is psi 0. Or if I write psi 0 as the density matrix, the Hamiltonian, T and the density matrix of psi 0 commute. These two statements are equivalent. In this case, this is a cat. And in this case, this is the density matrix associated to this cat. Okay? But when you pick these two states, they do not commute. So T and, let me call it psi up, is different from zero. But actually, almost every combination of them doesn't really commute. This one is the one that commutes the least, that does not commute the least. So in the sense that if I take the norm of this operator, it's the largest possible one. It's realized. The expectation value as the maximum in these two states, the expectation value of this commutator. However, if I choose psi sim, that is just 1 over square root of 2 of psi up plus psi down, by psi up I mean this one. And actually, also if I choose the anti-symmetric one, they commute. No, this is the cat. Well, it is. So if I write it like this, it's the cat. Yeah, so what's your... So this is the density matrix. Okay, so now this is the definition for the cat. Then if I do the cat bra of this, I have a psi sim. And in this case, I would have that T psi sim commute. Or that T applied to this gives me this again. So please let me liberal in switching from the cat and the density matrix. So these states break the symmetry, but there are states in the same manifold that do not break the symmetry. So when people say, oh, there is symmetry breaking in the limit of g equals 0, they are referring to having chosen a basis. Okay? So if you compute the magnetization in the maximally symmetry breaking states, you see that it is 1. Or in general, it's a number, let me call it n0, that depends on g. And perturbation theory will show you so that I start from 1, and until the critical point, which is where the perturbation theory fails, because to do perturbation theory, you need a gap, right? At the critical point, the gap closes. Then it goes to 0. So and this is actually the same behavior that you have for magnetization in the classicalizing mode, where in this case, this is the temperature. This is all at 0 temperature, and this is a parameter. And correlation function, sigma z, have the values of Caj as the value n0 squared. So it's not exponentially decaying. So this also shows you that between these two limits, there must be a quantum phase transition, because there is no way of connecting this correlation function, this function, to this function here that is exponentially decaying continuously. So in between, there is a quantum phase transition. And perturbation theory will show you that the critical point, GC, is equal 1. OK? So now that I have highlighted that the difference between the non-symmetry breaking phase and the symmetry breaking phase actually is the choice of a basis, we need to say something more, right? Because if it is just the choice of a basis, this has we must put some physical meaning into it. Because what distinguishes this basis from the basis with these two states that are also orthogonal. They're a perfectly good basis, and they don't break the symmetry. And so here is where the notion of spontaneous symmetry breaking comes into play. So what we mean by this is that in every physical realization, nature will spontaneously give us the symmetry breaking ones. So this is a fact. Okay? So also notice that the symmetry breaking ones are also product states, whereas the non-symmetry breaking ones are not only not a product, but they are a very macroscopic superposition. They're actually what we call a Schrödinger cat. So this is a large object, and this is a large object, and they're orthogonal, and they're in a superposition. So it's like alive plus dead. So we are just saying that spontaneously we don't see Schrödinger cats. So this needs an explanation, right? We cannot just say it. So the usual explanation is decoherence. And decoherence works in this way. You see, when we have selected our Hilbert space, where did I write it? Here. I've written it as the tensor product of a single spin 1/2 Hilbert spaces, right? But of course, I could write this Hilbert space with another tensor product structure. There is an infinite way, many ways of writing your Hilbert space that is two to the n dimensional with different tensor product structures or even no tensor product structures. Okay? So when I write it like this, and then I say, oh, and then I have a Hamiltonian that is made of R local operators in this tensor product structure. Because this tensor product structure is the one that is telling me who are the points in my set that make the graph. If I change the tensor product structure, I'm messing up everything. So what it means is that the physical degrees of freedom are the single spins. So this statement means a lot. It's a lot of commitment. It means that every time your system is subject to external perturbations, so to noise of some type, this noise has to couple to the physical degrees of freedom. So the physical degrees of freedom are the single spins operator. So this coupling must be local in the physical degrees of freedom. Now let's understand why this is a good basis, whereas this one, sorry, the symmetric one and the anti-symmetric one, is not. To go from here to here, what do I have to do? I have to apply my symmetry operator. These are the maximally symmetry breaking states, so I have to apply that operator. That operator is very non-local. Remember, I said it many times, it's a global operator in our physical degrees of freedom. If our environment or our noise in the Hamiltonian couples with some small, right, because it's some noise, small coupling with single spin operators, for the sake of simplicity, imagine just single spin operators, only at the n order in perturbation theory, you would have a tunneling due to noise between this state and this state. So the probability of tunneling between these two states goes like to e to the minus n, which means that if I prepare my state here, the lifetime goes like e to the n. In the thermodynamic limit, it's infinite. That is the order of limit I talked about yesterday. So these states at zero temperature, I'm talking right now, right? Because it's a ground state, the discussion for a finite temperature is more complicated. So these states are metastable. Now let's look at these states. And let me take one spin operator on one site, sigma z on any site j. And you see immediately this. So this happens at the first order in perturbation theory. So because they can be coupled, they are not metastable. The lifetime is something of order one. Doesn't depend on n. It is what it is. So at some point, these states are not metastable, whereas these are. So this is why spontaneously I get trapped in this sector, so of the spins that are up, instead of the sector where all the spin, where most of the spins are down. Okay? So we have learned something very important, is that what is the locality of our system, that is not just a definition, means that we have recognized what are the physical degrees of freedom that couple locally to random noise, to the environment, and usually also to our experimental capabilities of realizing a Hamiltonian, or of nature of realizing a Hamiltonian like that. So this choice determines a basis, a favored basis. So this argument is mainly due to Zurek and explains why there is no Schrödinger cats. And so you see that, I need one more minute. So if you read the original paper by Zurek, you see that locality in the interaction, this selects a basis, and this basis is classical in the sense that I choose the symmetry breaking ones, and the symmetry breaking ones are product states. They do not have this entanglement. They don't have this superposition. So, however, so this is all very good. It's all very good. But we are working in the limit g equals 0. So what happens when I have a small g? When I have a small g, now my ground states are not all spins up and all spins down, are still the ones that maximally break the symmetry. But now they're entangled. They're also very entangled. Actually, they are not less entangled if you measure entanglement than the Schrödinger cats. So it is still true. The coherence argument still works because it is still true that the coupling through sigma z, that is the so-called order parameter, is that operator that assumes a non-vanishing expectation value, so the magnetization. It's still true that the order parameter is also the one that is responsible for making me flip from the two symmetry broken ones. From the two, the other way around, the symmetric and the anti-symmetric, the ones that are not symmetry broken. So it's still true that the symmetry broken ones are the metastable ones. Okay? So the coherence still explains very well why we have spontaneous symmetry breaking. However, in terms of being more or less classical, or being more or less Schrödinger cat-like, it's not so clear anymore. Because even when g is different from zero, I say it again, even the symmetry broken ones are entangled. So how do we know that? I mean, can we still say that the symmetry broken ones are in some sense less Schrödinger cat than before? So this is a hard question, actually, because entanglement is difficult to compute. So keep it in mind, because I will show you a very, very, very recent solution, but we need some more mathematical tools for that. Okay, so we can finish with this and have a small announcement. So regarding the tutorials of the third week. So I was thinking that, so we can do this. That, so in the last two tutorials, I will come and we discuss together a research problem. Okay? And I think that this research problem that I have in mind is not too difficult. But I don't know. I didn't work it out, right? Otherwise, it's not a research problem. So we discuss it together. And I'm sniffing that the solution is out there, and we can work it out together. So if we do that, we write a paper. Okay. So in the but in order to do this problem, you need to be so we need to use all the tools that I will give you in the first 2 weeks. Okay. So this is also motivation for you guys to study and for me to explain it to you well so that you can work the solution out with me in the third week, okay? Okay, thanks.